Kids taken from their parents today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. An audio recording of migrant children in U.S. custody crying for their parents has gone viral. The emotions are raw. We'll get to the facts around the administration's zero-tolerance policy, plus an immigration judge who says hardline policies have turned her and her colleagues into immigration agents with a gavel.
That's been our problem, is that's the logical conclusion, that you become a law enforcement agent cloaked in a judicial robe.
And this Canadian economist who thinks Trump's America First policies are actually good for some Canadian businesses.
They're deciding to open up operations in the U.S. This is a very intelligent strategy by Canadian firms. It's not good for Canada, but it's good for Canadian firms.
Today, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Maybe you've heard it already, but here's some of that secretly recorded audio from ProPublica, the sound of migrant children in U.S. custody separated from their parents, and a note. I found this disturbing. A child is crying for her dad. Two people from the facility are with her. One says they'll put her in touch with someone from her consulate, but the child just keeps crying for Papa. And then she pleads with the staff, "Can I at least go with my aunt? I want her to come so she can take me to her house," says the girl. The other staff member asks the girl for the aunt's phone number and tries to assure her that they will call. Like I said, it is disturbing and it's unacceptable. That's according to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi. He spoke with the BBC.
It is absolutely wrong to separate children from their families in any circumstances, and particularly when people are in distress.
Grandi said that's the case with many of these people from Central America. They're fleeing violence and persecution, and the UN is calling on the Trump administration to change its policy. But today, Trump dismissed concerns about family separation and said this is a matter of protecting America's borders.
So what I'm asking Congress to do is to give us a third option, which we have been requesting since last year, the legal authority to detain and promptly remove families together as a unit. We have to be able to do this. This is the only solution to the border crisis. We have to stop child smuggling. This is the way to do it.
We've been watching this story play out for several weeks now, and there are contested versions of exactly what's going on. To talk us through it all, we now go to Lily Axelrod. She's an immigration attorney in Memphis. Out of all the misconceptions and lies you've been hearing about this story, what drives you the most crazy out of everything?
It's really disturbing to hear people say that family separation is required under the law. The law hasn't changed in the last couple of weeks. So if that were true, you would have been seeing this for years and years. This is a new policy that the Trump administration instituted. Previously, family units would be allowed to apply for asylum, as is their right under our current law. There's nothing illegal about asking for asylum and coming without previous permission. However, now the Trump administration is aggressively prosecuting the misdemeanor act of crossing the border without permission. And because, of course, children can't be sent to federal prisons, they are now being separated from their parents, even though their parents committed only a misdemeanor infraction of crossing the border.
So here's a statement from Mark Krikorian of the Conservative Center for Immigration Studies. He was on the show yesterday, and I want to play it for you and see if there's any misconception in here.
President Obama's policies, as well as some specific legal provisions and court settlements, tee up a situation where if you come in with a child, you cannot be prosecuted, and if you claim asylum, you can't be detained. You'll be let go. Essentially, what we're talking about here is that kids have become a kind of get-out-of-jail-free card.
So take it apart step by step for us. What is he talking about, and is it true?
The court settlement that he's referring to is the Flores settlement, which says that children must be held in the least restrictive setting possible. I hope it's not controversial that all of us agree that a child should not be sent to an adult federal prison. Children are certainly not a get out of jail free card. What has been happening until recently, and what has happened with many of my clients that I now represent, is that they are released into the United States, but with quite a lot of tracking. So they are required to check in with an ICE officer once or twice a month, whether in person or on the phone. They often wear ankle monitors for at least a year to show that they are complying with their court dates, that they've hired attorneys, that they are following through with their applications.
So that there are efforts being made to, so that these people just don't kind of disappear into American society.
Exactly. The alternative isn't prosecute and immediately deport or just release people into the interior with no idea what's going on. People can undergo background checks pretty quickly and then be released to pursue their legal cases while still being supervised within that system.
Can you just walk us through what happens when a parent with a child crosses the border without papers?
So the first officers that folks usually encounter are Customs and Border Protection officials who bring them to a local processing facility that is often called the ICE box because of their infamously low temperatures. They do fingerprints and brief interviews there. And what is supposed to happen is that if the parent or child expresses that they are afraid for their life in their home country, that they should be given a screening interview as soon as possible with an asylum officer, not to present the whole case, but to see whether they have met the basic requirements and have a credible fear of return. However, what we're seeing is happening instead is that Customs and Border Protection is turning over the parents to the Department of Justice for a prosecution of the crime of attempt to enter unlawfully, and then sending the children to shelters and detention centers separately from their parents with no idea when they will see their parents again.
I mean, you've done a great job answering a lot of my questions. What still confuses you when it comes to all of this stuff along the border with kids?
Honestly, I'm just truly not certain how these officials sleep at night. I am pregnant myself and have a young daughter coming in a few weeks. And the idea that anyone could try to take her away from me simply because I committed a misdemeanor offense or because I was trying to save her life fleeing from violence is simply unconscionable.
There's been a lot of pressure building up on the Trump White House around this from some previously unexpected quarters. Any hope for a positive outcome from all of this dilemma?
I do certainly hope that people of good conscience within the White House and within both political parties will be able to come together and find a way to protect asylum seekers, protect human rights at the border, and protect families who come together to seek protection in the United States.
Immigration attorney Lily Axelrod speaking with us from Memphis. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for covering this topic.
The vast majority of unaccompanied minors taken into custody at the U.S.-Mexico border this year came from the same Central American country, Guatemala. The number of migrant families from there reaching the U.S. this year has been going up as well. We wondered if people there were hearing about the news of families being separated at the U.S. border and if that was beginning to make Guatemalans think twice about making the trip north. We reached out to Ambassador Fernando Carrera. He represented Guatemala at the UN and served as the country's foreign minister. I asked him why so many Guatemalans have been trying to cross the border into the U.S. without documents this year.
On the one hand, poverty, definitely. But on the other hand, there is a pull factor from the U.S., which is family reunification. Many adults have migrated in the last 10, 15 years to the U.S. Now they want their children back, or they want, if not their children directly, but their nieces and cousins sometimes. So it's family reunification, the real pull factor. The strong family unity in indigenous communities particularly is a foundation of society.
So the Trump White House says that this new policy is intended to deter migrants who want to come to the U.S. I guess what I really want to know from you is how is that being heard in Guatemala? Are people seeing the news about families being separated? And are they saying, well, if that's the case, I'm not going to go to the U.S.? Is it deterring them?
That's a good question, because what happened last year at the beginning of the year is that Trump administration has said very clearly they were going to stop the migrants from getting into the U.S. Somehow the flow of migrants was reduced, but it only took 4 to 5 months until it went back again, rising the number of migrants. So maybe in the short term, last year, but I don't think it's going to avoid migration from Central America to the U.S. in the long term.
Sounds as though the Guatemalan government clarified its position yesterday. Tell us what the spokesperson said.
The spokesperson basically said that the government of Guatemala will respect the policies of migration of the United States, which means basically they are not complaining about the situation. This is a very weak position compared to, let's say, El Salvador, who said very clearly they want to stop this policy, that they have respect for other governments' affairs, but still, this is not a human rights situation they want to continue. And the other thing was the Mexico position that was just recently expressed by the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Mexico, calling clearly to stop this policy from the Trump administration.
So why do you think your government there in Guatemala City is backing the White House on this when a lot of other people are not?
I think most of the moves that the government does on foreign policy, this is related, for example, to the decision to move the embassy of Guatemala from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and other decisions that are a bit odd. These foreign policy decisions are very much related to the idea of the government that if they keep very close to the Trump administration, they will have some support to reduce the pressure of the International Commission Against Impunity and Corruption in Guatemala, and that somehow they will be freed from fighting corruption in the country. So the thing is, the government of Guatemala is basically trying to be close to the Trump administration in order to avoid more pressure from the U.S. administration on corruption issues in Guatemala.
It's interesting that Guatemala is backing the White House on this policy because Guatemala is the only Central American country that has a presence in Tucson to actually meet with and advise its nationals who are there. Apparently, it sends one of its representatives to the courthouse in Tucson every day to meet with the immigrants, and then they make a phone call back to the families of loved ones in Guatemala if their relatives have been detained. Doesn't that suggest that there's some concern in Guatemala about Trump's policy in protecting your own citizens?
What you're describing is what we call in Guatemala the consular protection program. Our consuls are doing what they have to do, and I'm very happy that they're doing that. We have to protect our migrants.
So the Guatemalan government isn't openly criticizing the family separation policy, but others, it sounds like, are critical in Guatemala and are upset by what's happening at the border.
Yes, by all means. This, I think, involves all sectors of society. I've heard declarations from public opinion makers from different ideologies. I have heard also declarations from religious groups, human rights groups within the country, communities, indigenous communities. So there's a widespread consensus against this policy, and it's expressed openly in the society, and the media has editorialized about this very clearly and very openly.
Fernando Carrera, the former Minister of Foreign Affairs in Guatemala, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The World, we turn to our Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell. She'll be joining me to talk about some of the immigration legislation being discussed this week and the push to address the issue of family separation at the southern border. There's been a lot of confusion here. I certainly have many more questions about all of this, and I have the feeling that you might too. What do you want to know about the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy? Send us an email with your questions to theworld@pri.org, and I will put those questions to Monica. That's The World, one word, theworld@pri.org. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It's kind of impossible to imagine human history without coal. Figuring out how to use coal to power machines and generate electricity pretty much made the modern world possible. But that's not the whole story, of course, because it also brought us big problems, like helping to disrupt the entire global climate system. That's why much of the world is now trying to move away from coal, and perhaps no country is moving faster in that direction than the place where the Industrial Revolution began, the United Kingdom. Our Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler has been digging into the story of coal in the UK and why things are so different there than they are here in the US. Here's part two of her story.
Great Britain was built on coal, quite literally.
Coal fueled the Industrial Revolution of Great Britain and put us where we are on the map.
Sean McLaughlin is a former miner. Now he works at the National Coal Mining Museum in Yorkshire.
It is ironic, yes.
McLaughlin's career arc pretty much tracks the fate of coal itself in the UK. Over the 40 years he spent in the industry, it went from being a central part of the UK's economy to a relic of the past. The sharp turn away from coal started in the 1980s with a strike that pitted miners and Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher against each other.
There was a sense before the strike of the industry being so important.
David Murray spent decades in the mines.
And I just think the industry lost that importance politically, economically, and everything.
Within a decade of that failed strike, the number of coal miners in the UK had fallen by 95%. The country was still burning a lot of coal, but more and more of it was being imported. And the decline of its domestic mining industry set the stage for an even more radical turn in the UK 30 years later.
It cannot be satisfactory for an advanced economy like the UK to be relying on polluting, carbon-intensive, 50-year-old coal-fired power stations.
That's former Energy Secretary Amber Rudd in 2015, announcing the UK would stop burning coal for electricity within a decade. It was a shift that few could have seen coming in the 80s. But lawmaker and environmental activist Brian E. Worthington says the country's priorities were evolving.
I think the turn of the millennium, there was a real sea change in attitude towards climate change. It started to get political attention in a way that it hadn't.
By the mid-2000s, the UK was trying to cut its greenhouse gas emissions, but it was struggling to do that, in part because the country still got about a third of its electricity from coal. Worthington was working at an environmental nonprofit at the time, and she helped craft a bill that would legally require the UK to cut its carbon emissions.
It introduced 5-year carbon budgets, and most importantly, it set some clear deadlines.
Now, around the same time Worthington was proposing this, climate change was also a growing concern in the US. But there, it was a political football. Coal companies still had outsized influence and employed 20 times more workers than in the UK. Fossil fuel companies were spending record amounts lobbying Congress as it considered climate legislation. So looking from the U.S., it seems astonishing how easily the climate change law passed in the U.K. Briony Worthington says there was no real opposition from coal interests.
That was not the main problem.
Even petroleum giants Shell and BP had been lobbying for climate legislation.
There were not the same level of climate skeptics that we see today. We didn't have that very well-resourced, very highly organized opposition.
The UK's Climate Change Act became law in 2008. It mandated an 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by mid-century, and it laid out a clear timetable.
So you have this legal metronome now that the government can't get out of.
The law was the most sweeping of its kind in the world. It set the stage for a carbon tax that went into effect a few years later that made coal more expensive than natural gas. And when that happened, University of Sheffield researcher Grant Wilson says it's like someone flipped a switch.
I think one of the things that really has taken many people by surprise, myself included, was just simply the rate of that change, the tipping point.
Underused natural gas plants revved up and coal plants were switched off. Renewables soared. And in just a few years, coal dropped from supplying more than 40% of the UK's electricity to just 7%.
For any modern industrial economy to change a third of its electricity supply in a 6-year period, it is really astonishing.
In late 2015, a month after the UK announced it would soon stop burning coal entirely, the country's last deep mine closed.
The last men from the last shift from the last deep mine colliery leave this place for good.
It was Kellingley Mine, where third-generation miner Sean McLaughlin started his career in 1977 as an apprentice and ended it decades later as the mine's manager.
We were the last miners. So yes, it was very emotional. There were lots of tears on site, saying goodbye to a lot of colleagues that I'd worked a long time with. So a very sad day, really.
McLaughlin takes me to Kellingley one morning, and it's quiet enough to hear birds chirping in the parking lot. He remembers what it was like during the boom years, when he'd have to jockey for a parking spot when shifts changed.
You look at it now, there's maybe 6 or 7 vehicles on this car park belonging to the demolition people. So it's really sad to look at this great industrial site as a state of demolition at the present time.
The mine itself is plugged with concrete.
And the pile of rubble just to the right-hand side, that's where my office used to be.
Earlier this year, the government laid out the final details of its plan to phase out coal by 2025. In the big picture, that's good for all of us. Burning coal is one of the biggest causes of climate change. But in the short term, it's not so good for people in coal regions, who still have lower than average employment rates and wages. And McLaughlin, for one, doesn't think the pain is worth it.
I'm a bit of a skeptic on this one. I think the small amount of coal that the UK burns isn't going to make much difference to the climate change.
He thinks the government is turning its back on people like him. He made a good living in the mines. It launched him out of public housing and gave his family a comfortable life.
I look at what a really good living it's provided me with, and I see my youngest son now is a school teacher. They do struggle. So, you know, I really feel sorry for young families of today wanting to bring a family into the world.
You hear the sentiment a lot in coal country in the U.S., but McLaughlin seems to be in the minority, even here in Yorkshire. Even as the power plants that were built on top of the coal fields start closing, many people around here don't seem too concerned, because they don't see coal as the present. They see it as history.
I was born at the right time and got out at the right time.
Guys like Robin Heath and a couple of friends who I met at a coffee shop in the village of Eggbro. It's right in the shadow of a coal-fired power plant that's closing this fall.
Well, I think it's inevitable, isn't it? You know, it's been on its way out for years. It's a shame, but it's time moves on, doesn't it? You know?
You seem very matter-of-fact about that. Is everyone sort of the same opinion?
The same. Just the same, really.
This is surprising to me, because all these guys work or used to work in the industry. Here's Dave Wiles.
I think it's inevitable, like Robin says. I think coal has had its day. If you believe all the scientists and experts on the damage it's doing, which I think there's enough evidence there now to support it, I think we are going the right way.
At the coal museum where Sean McLaughlin works now, a group of kids spills off the bus and heads to an old mine on site. It's likely the first time any of them will see a lump of coal in person. And in the country where King Coal was born, it may well be the last. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Yorkshire, England.
You can revisit part one of Carolyn's story on the UK and coal at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the North American Free Trade Agreement. It's been around for nearly a quarter century, and it's good for America, right?
We have people that have lost jobs because of NAFTA.
Aha, so it's bad then.
We're very happy with NAFTA. It has opened up our borders tremendously.
Cattle ranchers in South Dakota on NAFTA. That's still ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's a 24-year-old trade agreement, but NAFTA is back in the news in a big way. Talks aimed at renegotiating NAFTA have been going on since last August. The U.S., Canada, and Mexico have made some progress, but they don't appear close to agreement. President Trump has repeatedly threatened to abandon NAFTA if he can't get what he calls a better deal, and he did so again today.
Canada is not going to take advantage of the United States any longer, and Mexico is not going to take advantage of the United States any longer. And when I campaigned, I said, I will either renegotiate NAFTA or I'll terminate it.
Here at The World, we've been looking at how different parts of North America could be affected by changes to the trade agreement. As part of our 50 States project, The World's Jason Margolis met with some cattle ranchers in South Dakota.
This is a story about two ranchers in western South Dakota. First, there's Kenny Fox.
Well, we run about a 500-cow, mother-cow operation.
And second, there's Eric Jennings.
Right now, we're running about 50 cows, mother cows. I downsized, I think, 3 years ago now.
The two men have both been busy vaccinating and branding their calves and preparing to get hay ready for winter. Fox is in his 60s. Jennings is in his 50s. Their lives, jobs, and outlooks have a lot of overlap. Where the two men differ sharply, however, is on trade. I met separately with the two ranchers on their farms. Here's Fox.
We have people that have lost jobs because of NAFTA.
And Jennings.
We're very happy with NAFTA. It has opened up our borders tremendously.
NAFTA got rid of tariffs and quotas on beef. Since it came into effect 24 years ago, U.S. beef exports to Mexico have increased by more than 450%. Exports to Canada have more than doubled. But beef is going in every direction. Imports from Canada and Mexico have also risen sharply. And that's why Fox, the farmer opposed to NAFTA, doesn't like the trade deal. The U.S. has accumulated a $32 billion trade deficit for beef products in the time of NAFTA.
I don't think we need as many cattle coming into this country as there is. And that is causing people to go out of business. It's causing young people not to go in because it costs so much money to get started.
Now, economists say trade deficits don't really matter. It's simply a reflection of products going to where there's demand. And since NAFTA came into effect, beef production is up in all three nations. Still, for established cattlemen like Fox, with more competition, they do more work for less money. And he says times have been tough.
We repair what we got instead of buying new. We don't build new fences. We just kind of limp along and hope for the best.
These days, however, he's got more hope that things will change.
President Trump is the only ally that we really have, I feel, at this time. And I feel that he has done more in the short time he's been there than any president that I know of in my lifetime.
Fox is a member of RCAF USA, a nationwide organization of cattle ranchers. Bill Bullard is the CEO. Driving through South Dakota, Bullard says since NAFTA came into effect, imports of Mexican and Canadian products have taken a toll.
Since the 1994 implementation of NAFTA, we have lost 20% of all of our beef cattle operations in the United States.
There have been other factors at play during that time: droughts, technological advances, and consolidation of farms. Bullard says they're not opposed to competition, just unfair competition. He says stricter American regulations make it more expensive to produce beef here than in Canada or Mexico. Bullard says the trade agreement needs some key revisions to protect American cattle ranchers.
If Mexico can produce cattle far cheaper than the United States, then we should add tariffs to that product coming into this country so that our beef produced under the U.S. production regime can compete with the Mexican cattle.
And Bullard says if NAFTA can't be fixed,
we should rip it up.
So that's the organization RCAF. There's a competing group, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. The headline of their one-page summary reads, U.S. Beef Under NAFTA, an Export Success Story. As a cattle rancher, you kind of have to choose sides, like going with the Mets or the Yankees. Eric Jennings, the rancher who supports NAFTA, chose the Cattlemen's Beef Association, but he's a fish out of water in South Dakota.
Yeah, I'm surrounded with RCAF members.
Do you argue with them? Or?
I think that I know their position, and they know my position, and we all get along. We all work together. You know, we respectfully disagree with each other. We know that we're not going to change each other's minds.
Jennings says since NAFTA came into effect, his cattle have actually become more valuable.
We sell a lot of round cuts. That's a rump cut off of a steer. They go down to Mexico. You know, they also take a lot of tongue. We don't eat a lot of tongue in America.
He says exporting tongues and livers, and not just to Mexico and Canada, gets him an extra $150 to $180 per head of cattle. He says accepting imports in return, that's just part of free trade. And he says a lot of Mexican and Canadian beef imports get mixed in with American hamburger meat. That frees them up to export higher value cuts, like flat iron steaks to other nations. Jennings says he doesn't want to go back to the way things were before NAFTA.
It takes a long time to build relationships for trade, and it doesn't take very long to get rid of them and to destroy that relationship. And you know, and it's a competitive world, and there's other countries looking to move in on the markets that America has right now.
For the world, Jason Margolis, Belvedere, South Dakota.
So how is all this looking for Mexico? We checked in with the head of trade in NAFTA at Mexico's embassy in Washington.
I'm Guillermo Malpica.
Malpica says NAFTA has been good for Mexico's beef exporters.
I can share with you that 10 years ago we exported 31,000 tons of beef to the U.S., and last year we exported seven times that amount.
It's a complementary relationship, he says. Mexico imports U.S. grain to feed cattle there, and Malpica says he hopes that Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. can all agree on an updated version of NAFTA, because Mexico isn't interested in a bilateral deal with the U.S., he says.
We don't believe that is a feasible option. We believe that mainly the benefits from NAFTA come from the fact that we are developing North American region as a whole.
And what if the U.S. does walk away from NAFTA, as President Trump has threatened to do as recently as today? Malpica says Mexico will look to other markets and other trade partners. Whatever you think of Trump's scuffling with Canada and Mexico over trade, his policies are having a real-world impact. For example, the economy in Canada is falling behind America's. Philip Cross is the former chief economic analyst for the Canadian government Statistics Canada. He's now a senior fellow at the MacDonald Laurier Institute in Ottawa.
Well, Canada's doing well, but what's notable is that over the last year especially, it's really begun to fall behind the rate of growth in the U.S. The underlying growth of the U.S. economy these days is around 3%. In Canada, it's half that at around 1.5%. Our unemployment rate is 4.8%. That's a full point higher than in the U.S. So, our economy was doing very well in 2017, but it slowed down remarkably in 2018, even as the U.S. has picked up. And normally, our two economies are very closely aligned.
You also noted last week in an article in Canada's Financial Post a big difference in the investment climate in Canada and the U.S. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, a lot of this divergence that's opened up between Canada and the U.S. seems to come back to in business investment. In the U.S., we're seeing investment growth of almost 10%, a response partly to the big corporate tax cuts we've seen in the U.S. But in Canada, we're seeing a fourth straight year of declining business investment. So this gap between Canada and the U.S., it's opened up in terms of overall growth. A lot of it comes back to business investment.
And how much is that business investment in the U.S. being fueled by Canadian businesses that are coming here?
We don't know precisely, but there's a lot of evidence that numerous firms, especially in the auto sector and in the oil and gas sector, because of the uncertainty surrounding trade between Canada and the U.S., they're deciding to open up operations in the U.S. This is a very intelligent strategy by Canadian firms. It's not good for Canada, but it's good for Canadian firms. Because once you've established operations in the U.S., if the U.S. slaps tariffs on imports coming from Canada, you're already set up in the U.S., so it doesn't affect you. If free trade is maintained between Canada and the U.S., you're positioned to export back into Canada from the U.S. So setting up satellite operations in the U.S. is the smart thing to do, and it seems that a number of firms are doing that.
So you bundle up the attractive investment landscape here, the low unemployment rate, 3% growth. How serious does all this look to Canada?
Well, it's very serious because once you start infecting long-term investment commitments, you're institutionalizing, you're solidifying this weakness for possibly years to come.
In your analysis, then, what's underlying this difference between the U.S. and Canadian economies?
Well, I think it's partly the uncertainty surrounding trade talks, which could very well be a deliberate strategy by the Trump administration to create this uncertainty that gives people an incentive to open up operations in the U.S. It's partly the increased attractiveness of the U.S. because of lower tax rates. But it's also, it's not just pull factors into the U.S. It's also partly push, that there's a lot of governments have taken actions that are regarded by the business community in Canada as quite unfriendly.
Is a basic worry in Canada that the U.S. Under Trump's America First kind of strategy, that even loyal old allies like Canada will be thrown under the bus?
I think that's just dawning on policymakers now that as the rhetoric from the Trump administration has really ramped up over the last couple of weeks and tariffs have actually been applied to the metals such as steel and aluminum, I think people are beginning to realize now just how tough a negotiation this is going to be and that past favors aren't going to count for anything. This administration is going to pursue what's good for the United States first, second, and third. And people who are counting on goodwill from this administration, I think that the blinders are quickly being raised from their eyes.
So, Philip Cross, what is your takeaway here? I mean, Canadians may not be happy to say it, but is Trumpism winning?
I think so. I think Trump is always, the U.S. is always going to win in trade negotiations because they hold the ultimate card. Access to the U.S. market, the largest in the world, is so important to everybody, whether it's China, Japan, the U.S., Canada, Europe. The U.S. is in a position to extract a lot more than it has in the past. So we have an administration now that is really pursuing U.S. interests and advantages to the maximum. We probably haven't seen this before, and it's introducing a whole different dynamic into the relationship between U.S. and its allies.
Philip Cross is Statistics Canada's former chief economic analyst. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Merkel.
A battle to capture a seaport city in Yemen is entering its second week. Coalition troops led by Saudi Arabia have just captured part of the airport just south of that city. And inside the city of Hodeidah, residents can hear planes dropping bombs. They can hear artillery, mortars, lots of explosions. One resident tells us that the rebels who control the city, the group Ansar Allah, also known as the Houthis, she says they've dug up some of the city streets to make roadblocks. They're literally digging in for the fight. People in Hodeidah are scared that the battle will soon come right to their neighborhoods. The head of Middle East Operations for the International Committee of the Red Cross is also scared.
We know that we're talking about asymmetrical warfare in a densely populated area. There is a potential for grave humanitarian problems.
Robert Mardini says capturing a city of 600,000 people is no small battle, and some Hodeidah residents are already suffering.
This happened against the backdrop of an already dire situation, and any intense fighting inside Hodeidah city would exacerbate an already catastrophic humanitarian situation.
Today, his organization was placing food packages around the city to prepare for the worst. Fighting could make it hard to deliver them later. The World Food Program is also doing the same thing, and it has three supply ships standing by offshore.
The three ships are carrying 75,000 tons of wheat grain. That is enough to feed 6 million people for 1 month.
The program's Abir Atifa says they're getting ready for the long haul.
We also have pre-positioned 1.2 million liters of fuel in Hodeidah to be used for all other agencies to support hospitals, clean water facilities, and Hodeidah governorate.
Aid groups talk about Hodeidah as if the worst could happen. Interestingly, the countries trying to take control of Hodeidah back from the Houthi rebels, those countries also use humanitarian language.
Let me try to define the Hodeidah operation from our angle. It's both a military and humanitarian operation fused into each other. It's not one or another.
That's the ambassador from the United Arab Emirates to the U.S., Yusuf Al-Otaiba.
If you look back and see the areas where UAE and Yemeni forces with UAE assistance have taken space from the Houthis in the last 6 months or 8 months, I think you will find a consistent pattern that wherever that area has been removed from Houthi control, humanitarian and security environment has improved.
Some aid groups and residents dispute that characterization. People we spoke with in Hodeidah fear that none of the fighting forces are willing to give in, not just the Houthis, but also forces from the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Sudan, plus Yemeni groups with many competing interests. Robert Mardini of the ICRC urges all sides to observe the rules of war and protect civilian lives.
We hope, of course, that a negotiated solution will be found for Hodeidah to avert a catastrophic scenario. I mean, we have seen in the region fightings in places like Mosul, Raqqa, Homs, Aleppo had a devastating impact on the life and livelihoods of people. And we hope that parties to the conflict will find solutions that would avert such scenarios to materialize in Hodeidah today.
Our thoughts are with the people of Hodeidah as we enter another night of bombing. We'll keep you posted on the developments. In all the talk about ramped up immigration enforcement and changes to asylum law, there's another piece here that sometimes gets less attention. The immigration courts are jam-packed with cases. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez recently spent the day at one of the busiest immigration courts in the country in Los Angeles.
From the outside, there is nothing special about the building at 606 South Olive Street in downtown Los Angeles. If anything, the 50-year-old office tower is dingy compared to newer, swankier buildings around it. But if you're an immigrant fighting deportation, what happens inside this building is all important. That's because it's LA's U.S. Immigration Courthouse, one of 57 in the country. And the decisions judges make here about who gets to stay or go from the U.S. can dramatically change people's lives.
It definitely is a matter of life and death for a good part of our clients.
Patricia Ortiz is with Esperanza Immigrant Rights Project. It provides pro bono legal help to people in immigration court, many of whom are seeking asylum because of violence and unrest back home.
There is a very real fear and possibility that if returned, our clients will die.
Will die?
Yes.
And if that sounds overly dramatic, it's what Jorge Garcia, who's 18, told me as he left the immigration courthouse one morning. In the U.S. alone and appearing before a judge without a lawyer, Jorge says there's only danger for him in Honduras, where he's from. He says gangs have threatened his life. But critics say the Trump administration's immigration crackdown could make it harder for Jorge and thousands of others to get a fair hearing in the courts. And many immigration judges are appalled by what's happening.
As a public servant, as a judge, I promised that I was going to follow the Constitution. I promised that I was going to follow the law.
That's Ashley Tabador, an immigration judge in L.A. She says speed and toughness are being placed above due process and judicial independence. And it's time for immigration judges to speak out.
I think every one of us, every one of the judges is here to protect America. And we do so by honoring our oath, by making sure that the rule of law is being applied, and making sure that the judges are acting truly independently and impartially.
What you're saying is, you know, you're not another kind of ICE agent in a robe.
Absolutely. I mean, that's been our problem, is that's the logical conclusion, that you become a law enforcement agent cloaked in a judicial robe.
Tabador, who's also president of the National Association of Immigration Judges, is especially concerned about a new policy of courtroom quotas, saying America's immigration courts are backlogged with too many cases. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has required that judges rule on a certain number of cases a year or face penalties.
What is wrong with that is that it's truly unprecedented. We're not aware of any other judge across the country whose job is on the line directly for not completing certain number of cases in a certain period of time. What it does is it makes the judge an interested party in the case, because now the judge has to be thinking, am I going to lose my job if I don't do this case quickly, if I don't get it done within this year?
But even before Trump, things were tough for people in immigration proceedings. Unlike criminal defendants and other courts, they are not appointed a lawyer, a public defender, and legal aid can be scarce with few resources.
We have one printer. We have our laptops that we bring in every day because we can't actually lock the room that we use. So we have to carry our stuff every morning, and that's it.
That's Patricia Ortiz again, talking about how her nonprofit sets up a legal aid table in waiting rooms at the immigration court in L.A. She says most immigrants summoned to the building can be scared and confused.
We see this all the time. People don't really understand why they're even there. They know that they have to go see a judge, but they don't really know what it means. They don't know what to expect. And so they're really looking to us for guidance.
And guidance is needed more than ever in immigration courts as the Trump administration enforces its zero tolerance policies. If the numbers continue, prosecutions of immigrants in the country without authorization will jump nearly 20% this year compared to last year. Judge Tabador doesn't think toughness and speed can coexist with justice. There are days she feels dispirited, but she says she'll continue fighting for the independence of the immigration courts.
I'm not going to give up hope. I'm not going to give up fighting for the court and the judges and our American judicial system. I just refuse to think that way right now. Because I think if you think that way, then that's a defeatist mentality, and I don't intend to be defeated.
For the World, Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
Our last item today is also about the challenges of migration. Fatoumata Jawara is a singer from Mali we've had on the show before. She's also an actress, and that's what she was up to in 2001 when she emigrated from West Africa to France. She was 19 and left her parents and 10 siblings to join a theater company. But times were different in 2001. It was easier to pack up and move, to migrate. But now, with borders tightening up and nationalism on the rise, Fatoumata Jawara has changed her thinking, seeing the risks migrants from Mali take as they head across the Mediterranean in flimsy boats.
I want people to see how brave those young people, you know, going on the sea and going where they want to be, to, you know, be free to travel. But in the same time, you must tell them to say, oh, guys, please, maybe wait until we get a solution to let everybody be traveling as he wants. And, you know, it's a process. We must have a conversation about it. We must talk. I've been there. I know what's going on. So be careful, brother. Be careful, sister. Be aware. Traveling is not the only solution, you know.
When you've been traveling, Fatoumata, what is the best part of coming home to Bamako? What do you do first, the second you arrive?
We got a traditional food which is called the to.
To is made from millet or sorghum and kind of a bread.
Traditional,
you dip it in all sorts of sauces.
Food, yeah. You know, our food. The food is like reminding my roots, my heritage, my human, you know, my personal, my ancestral, my African blood, my African being. See, it's just like everything. It's my soul.
That was Malian musician Fatoumata Jawara. She opens her new album with a song about migration. It's called Derini, and it's exactly how I remember Fatoumata from her previous work. Energetic, strong, and not messing around. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
I want to know.
PRI, Public Radio International.